Half an hour later, after keeping the press waiting only 10 minutes past the appointed time, Peter walked alone onto the platform at one end of the packed conference room. All the reporters were holding up their little steadicams, the lenses peering out between the fingers of their clenched fists. It was the best turnout he had ever had at a press conference, though to be fair, he'd never actually held one in the United States. Maybe here they would all have been like this. "I'm as surprised as you are to find myself here today," said Peter with a smile. "But I must say I'm grateful to the source that provided me with information that allowed me to make my exit, along with my family, from a place that had once been a safe haven, but which had become the most dangerous place in the world to me. I'm also grateful to the government of the United States, which not only invited me to bring the office of hegemon here on a temporary basis, of course, but also provided me with a generous contingent of the Secret Service to secure the area. I don't believe they're necessary, at least not in such numbers, but then, until recently, I didn't think I needed any protection inside the hegemony compound in Ribeirão Preto." His smile invited a laugh, and he got one. More of a release of tension than real amusement, but it would do. Father had stressed that. Make them laugh now and then, so everybody feels relaxed. That will make them think that you're relaxed, and confident, too. "My information suggests that the many loyal employees of the Office of Hegemon are in no danger whatsoever, and when a new permanent headquarters is established, I invite all those who want to resume their jobs. The disloyal employees, of course, already have other employment." Another laugh, but a couple of audible groans, too. The press smelled blood, and it didn't help that Peter looked and was so very young. Humor, yes, but don't look like a wisecracking kid. Especially don't look like a wisecracking kid whose parents had to drag him out of bed this morning. "I will not give you any information that would compromise my recent benefactor. What I can tell you is this. My inconveniently sudden journey, this disruption in the office of hegemon, is entirely my fault." There. That wasn't what a kid would say. That wasn't even what adult politicians usually said. "Against the advice of my military commander and others, I brought the notorious Achille Flandre, at his own request and with his assurances of loyalty to me, into my compound. I was warned that he could not be trusted, and I believed those warnings. However, I thought I was clever enough and careful enough to detect any betrayal on his part in plenty of time. That was a miscalculation on my part. Thanks to the help of others, it was not a fatal one. The disinformation now coming from Achille Flandre in the former hegemony compound about my alleged embezzlement is, of course, false. I've always maintained the financial records of the hegemony in public. The broad categories of income and disbursement have been published every year on the nets, and this morning I've opened up the entire set of financial records of the hegemony and my own personal records on a secure site with the address Hegemon Financial Disclosure. Except for a few secret items in the budget, which any military analyst can tell you is barely enough to account for the very few military actions of my office over the past few years, every dollar is accounted for. And yes, we do keep those records in dollars, since the hegemony currency has fluctuated widely in value, but with a distinctly downward trend in recent years. Another laugh. But everyone was writing like crazy, too, and he could see that this policy of full disclosure was working. "Besides seeing that nothing has been embezzled from the hegemony," Peter went on, "you will also see that the hegemony has been working with extremely limited funds. It's been a challenge, with so little money, to marshal the nations of the world to oppose the imperialistic designs of a so-called universal people's state, otherwise known as the Chinese Empire. We have been extremely grateful to those nations who have continued to support the hegemony at one level or another. In deference to some of them who prefer their contribution remain secret, we have withheld some 20 names. You are free to speculate about their identity, but I We'll say neither yes nor no, except to tell you candidly that China is not one of them. The biggest laugh yet. And a couple of people even clapped their hands a few times. I am outraged that the usurper Achille Flandre has called into question the credentials of the Minister of Colonization. But if there were any doubt about Flandre's plans, the fact that this was his first act should tell you a great deal about the future he plans for us all. Achille Flandre will not rest until every human being is under his complete control, or, of course, dead. Peter paused, looked down at the rostrum, as if he had notes there, though of course he didn't. One thing I do not regret, however, about bringing Achille Flandre to Riberaun Pretou, is that I've had a chance now to take his measure as a human being, though it is only by the broadest definition that I include him in that category. Achille Flandre has achieved his power in the world not by his own intelligence or courage, but by exploiting the intelligence and courage of others. He engineered the kidnapping of the children who helped my brother, Ender Wiggin, save humanity from the alien invaders. Why? Because he knew that he himself did not have any hope of ruling the world if any of them were working against him. Achille Flandre's power comes from the willingness of others to believe his lies. But his lies will no longer bring him new allies as they have in the past. He has hitched his little wagon to China and drives China like an ox. But I have heard him laughing at the poor fools in the Chinese government who believed him, mocking them for their petty ambitions as he told me how unworthy they were to have him guiding their affairs. No doubt much of this was merely part of his attempt to convince me that he was no longer working with them. But his ridicule was by name and very specific. His contempt for them was genuine. I almost feel sorry for them. Because if his power is ever solidified and he has no further use for them, then they will see what I saw. Of course, he has scorn for me as well, and if he's laughing at me right now, I can only agree with him. I was snookered, ladies and gentlemen. In that, I joined a distinguished company, some of whom fell from power in Russia after the kidnappings, some of whom are now suffering as political prisoners after China's conquest of India, and some of whom even now are arresting people in India for carrying stones. I only hope that I will turn out to be the last person so vain and foolish as to think that Achille Flandre can be controlled or exploited to serve some higher purpose. Achille Flandre serves only one purpose, his own pleasure. And what pleases him would be to rule over every man, woman, and child in the human race. I was not a fool when I committed the hegemony to opposing the imperialistic acts of the Chinese government. Now, because of my own mistakes, the prestige of the hegemony is temporarily diminished. But my opposition to the Chinese Empire's oppression of more than half the people of the world is not diminished. I am the implacable enemy of emperors. That was as good a stopping point as any. Peter bowed his head briefly to acknowledge their polite applause. Some in the crowd applauded more than politely, but he was also aware of those who did not clap at all. The questions began then, but because he had accused himself from the start, he fielded them easily. Two questioners tried to get more information on the source who tipped him off, and what it was he tipped Peter off about. But Peter only said, "If I say anything more on this subject, someone who has been kind to me will certainly die. I'm surprised you would even ask." After the second time he said this, word for word, no one asked such a question again. As to those whose questions were merely veiled accusations, he agreed with all those who implied that he'd been foolish. When he was asked if he had proven himself too foolish to hold the office of hegemon, his first reply was a joke. "I was told when I took the job in the first place that accepting it proved I was too dim-witted to serve." Laughter, of course. And then he said, but I have tried to use that office to serve the cause of peace and self-government for all of humanity, and I challenge anyone to show that I did anything other than advance that cause as much as possible with the resources I had. 15 minutes later, he apologized for having no further time. But please email me any further questions you might have, and my staff and I will try to get answers back to you in time for your deadlines. One final word before I go. They fell silent, waiting. The future happiness of the human race depends on good people who want to live at peace with their neighbors and who are willing to protect their neighbors from those who don't want peace. I'm only one of those people. I'm probably not the best of them, and I hope to God I'm not the smartest. But I happen to be the one who is entrusted with the office of hegemon. Until my term expires, or I am lawfully replaced by the nations that have supported the hegemony, I will continue to serve in that office. More applause. And this time he allowed himself to believe that there might be some real enthusiasm in it. He came back to his room, exhausted. Mother and father were there, waiting. They'd refused to go downstairs with him. "If your mother and father are with you," Father had said, "then this better be the press conference where you resign. But if you intend to stay in office, then you go down there alone. Just you. No staff, no parents, no friends, no notes. Just you." Father had been right. Mother had been right, too. Ender, bless his little heart, was the example he had to follow. If you lose, you lose, but you don't give up. "How did it go?" asked Mother. "Well enough, I think," said Peter. I took questions for 15 minutes, but they were starting to repeat themselves or get off on wild tangents, so I told them to email me any further questions. "What was it carried on the vid?" "We polled 30 news stations," said Father, "and the top 20 or so news webs, and most of them had it live." "So you watched?" said Peter. "No, we flipped through," said Mother. "But what we saw looked and sounded good. You didn't bat an eye. I think you brought it off." "We'll see." "Long term," said Father, "you're going to have a bumpy couple of months, especially because you can count on it that Ashiel hasn't emptied his quiver yet." "Bow and arrow analogies," said Peter. "You are so old." They chuckled at his joke. "Mom, Dad, thanks." "All we did," said Father, "was what we knew that tomorrow you would have wished we had done today." Peter nodded. Then he sat down on the edge of the bed. "Man, I can't believe I was so dumb. I can't believe I didn't listen to Bean and Petra and Suri and..."
"And to us," said Mother helpfully.
"And you and Graf," said Peter. "You trusted your own judgment," said Father, "and that's exactly what you have to do. You were wrong, this time. But you haven't been wrong often, and I doubt you'll ever be this wrong again." "For heaven's sake, don't start taking a vote on your decision," said Mother, "or looking at opinion polls, or trying to guess how your actions will play with the press." "No, I won't," said Peter. "Because, you see, you're locked," said Mother. "You already ended one war. After a few days or weeks, the press will start remembering that. And you're Demosthenes. You have quite a fervent following."
"Had," said Peter.
"They saw what they expected from Demosthenes," said Mother. "You didn't weasel. You didn't make excuses. You took the blame you deserved and refused the accusations that were false. You put out your evidence."
"That was good advice, Dad.
Thanks," said Peter. "And," said Mother, "you showed courage."
"By running away from Riberaun, pray to, before anyone so much as glared at me?"
"By getting out of bed," she answered.
Peter shook his head. "And my courage is nothing but borrowed courage."
"Not borrowed," said Mother. "Stored up in us. Like a bank. We've seen your courage, and we saved some for you when you temporarily ran out. Needed some of it back.
Cash flow problem. That's all it was, said Father. How many times are you two going to have to save me from myself before this whole drama runs its course?
I think, 6 times, said Father.
No, 8, said Mother.
You two think you're so cute, said Peter.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
A knock at the door. Room service, called a voice from outside. Father was at the door in 2 quick strides.
3 tomato juices, he asked.
No, 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 nothing like that. Lunch. Sandwiches? Bowl of ice cream?
Even with that reassurance, Father stepped to the side of the door and pulled it open as far as the lock bar allowed. Nobody fired a weapon. And the guy with the food laughed.
Everybody forgets to undo that thing. Happens all the time.
Father opened the door and stepped outside long enough to make sure nobody else was in the hall, waiting to follow room service inside. When the waiter was coming through the door, Peter turned around to get out of his way, just in time to see Mother slipping a pistol back into her purse.
"Since when did you start packing?" he asked her.
"Since your chief of computer security turned out to be Achille's good friend," she said.
"Ferreira?" asked Peter.
"He's been telling the press that he installed Snoopware to find out who was embezzling funds and was shocked to discover it was you."
"Oh," said Peter, "of course, they ran a press conference opposite mine. But almost everybody carried yours live, and his was just excerpted. And they all followed the Ferreira clip with a repeat of you announcing that you were posting the hegemony financial records on the nets."
"Oh, I bet we crashed the server."
"No, all the news organizations cloned it, first thing."
Father had finished signing off on the meal, and the waiter was gone. The door relocked.
"Let's eat," said Father. "If I recall, this place always has great lunches."
"It's good to be home," said Mother.
"Well, not home, but in town, anyway."
Peter took a bite, and it was good. They had ordered exactly the sandwich he would have ordered. That's how well they knew him. Their lives really were focused on their children. He couldn't have ordered their sandwiches. 3 place settings on the little rolling cart the waiter had wheeled in. There should have been 5.
"I'm sorry," he said.
"For what?" asked Father, his mouth full.
"That I'm the only kid you've got on earth."
"Could be worse," said Father.
"Could have been none." And Mother reached over and patted his hand.
Chapter 13, Caliph. From Graf, Pilgrimage at Colman.gov to Locke Erasmus at Polnet.gov. Re, the better part of valor. I know you don't want to hear from me, but given that you are no longer in a secure situation and our mutual foe is playing again on the world stage, I offer you and your parents sanctuary. I am not suggesting that you go into the colony program. Quite the contrary, I regard you as the only hope of rallying worldwide opposition to our foe. That is why your physical protection is of the utmost importance to us. For that reason, I have been authorized to invite you to a facility off-planet for a few days, a few weeks, a few months. It has full connections to the nets, and you will be returned to Earth within 48 hours of your request. No one will even know you are gone. But it will put you out of reach of any attempt either to kill or capture you or your parents. Please take this seriously. Now that we know our enemy has not severed his connections with his previous host, certain intelligence already obtained now makes a different kind of sense. Our best interpretation of this data is that an attempt on your life is imminent. A temporary disappearance from the surface of the Earth would be very useful to you right now. Think of it as the equivalent of Lincoln's secret journey through Baltimore in order to assume the presidency. Or, if you prefer a less lofty precedent, Lenin's journey to Russia in a sealed railroad car.
Petra assumed that she had been taken to Damascus because Ambul had succeeded in making contact with Alai, but neither of them met her at the airport, nor was there anyone waiting for her at the security gates. Not that she wanted someone carrying a sign that said Petra Arcanian. She might as well send Achille an email telling him where she was. She had felt nauseated through the entire flight, but she knew it could not possibly be from pregnancy, not this quickly. It took at least a few hours for the hormones to start to flow. It had to be the stark fear that started when she realized that if Eli's people could find exactly where she was and have a cab waiting for her, so could Ashiel's. How did Bean know to choose the cab he chose for her? Was it some predilection for Indonesians? Did he reason from evidence she didn't even notice? Or did he choose the third cab simply because he didn't trust the concept of next in line? What cab had he got into, and who was driving it? Someone bumped into her from behind, and for a moment she had a rush of adrenaline as she thought, "This is it. I'm being killed by an assassin who approached me from behind because I was too stupid to look around." After the momentary panic and the momentary self-blame, she realized that, of course, it was not an assassin. It was simply a passenger from her flight hurrying to get out of the airport, while she, uncertain and lost in her own thoughts, had been walking too slowly and obstructing traffic. "I'll go to a hotel," she thought, "but not one that Europeans always go to. But wait, if I go to a hotel where everybody but me is Arab-looking, I'll stand out. That's too obvious. Bean would tease me for not having developed any useful survival habits, though at least I thought twice before checking into an Arab hotel." The only luggage she had was the bag she was carrying over her shoulder, and at customs she went through the usual questions. "This is all your luggage?" "Yes." "How long do you plan to stay?" "Couple of weeks, I expect." 2 weeks and no more clothing than this. I plan to shop." It always aroused suspicions to enter a country with too little luggage, but as Bean said, it's better to have a few more questions at customs or passport control than to have to go to the baggage claim area and stand around where bad people have plenty of time to find you. The only thing worse, in Bean's view, was to use the first restroom in the airline terminal. "Everybody knows women have to pee incessantly," said Bean. "Actually, it's not incessant, and most men don't notice even if it is," said Petra. But considering that Bean seemed never to need to pee at all, she supposed that her normal human need seemed excessive to him. She was well trained now, however. She didn't even glance at the first restroom she passed, or the second. She probably wouldn't use a bathroom until she got to her hotel. "Bean, when are you coming? Did they get you onto the next flight? How will we find each other in this city?" She knew he would be furious, however, if she lingered in the airport hoping to meet his flight. For one thing, she had no idea where his flight would be coming from. He was wont to choose very odd itineraries, so that he could very easily be on a flight from Cairo, Moscow, Algiers, Rome, or Jerusalem. No, it was better to go to a hotel, check in under an alias that he knew about, and... "Mrs. Delphiki?" She turned at once at the sound of Bean's mother's name, and then realized that the tall, white-haired gentleman was addressing her. "Yes," she laughed. "I'm still not used to the idea of being called by my husband's name."
"Forgive me," said the man. "Do you prefer your birth name?"
"I haven't used my own name in many months," said Petra. "Who sent you to meet me?"
"Your host," said the man.
"I have had many hosts in my life," said Petra, "some of whom I do not wish to visit again."
"But such people as that would not live in Damascus."
There was a twinkle in his eye. Then he leaned in close.
"There are names that it is not good to say aloud."
"Well, mine apparently not being one of them," she said with a smile.
"In this time and place," he said, "you are safe while others might not be."
"I'm safe because you're with me."
"You are safe because I and my... what is your battle school slang? My jish... and I are here watching over you."
"I didn't see anybody watching over me."
"You didn't even see me," said the man. "This is because we're very good at what we do."
"I did see you. I just didn't realize you had taken any notice of me."
"As I said."
She smiled. Very well, I will not name our host, and since you won't either, I'm afraid I can't go with you anywhere.
Oh, so suspicious, he said with a rueful smile. Very well, then. Perhaps I can facilitate matters by placing you under arrest.
He showed her a very official-looking badge inside a wallet, though she had no idea what organization had issued the badge, since she had never learned the Arabic alphabet, let alone the language itself. But Bean had taught her, listen to your fear and listen to your trust. She trusted this man, and so she believed his badge without being able to read it. So you're with Syrian law enforcement, she said?
As often as not, he replied,
smiling again as he put his wallet away. Let's walk outside, she said.
Let's not, he said. Let's go into a little room here at the airport.
A toilet stall, she asked, or an interrogation room?
My office, he said.
If it was an office, it was certainly well disguised. They got to it by stepping behind the El Al ticket counter and going into the employee's back room.
El Al? She asked. You're Israeli?
Israel and Syria are very close friends for the past 100 years. You should keep up on your history.
They walked down a corridor lined with employee lockers, a drinking fountain, and a couple of restroom doors.
I didn't think the friendship was close enough to allow Syrian law enforcement to use Israel's national airline, said Petra.
I lied about being with Syrian law enforcement, he said.
And did they lie out front about being El Al? He palmed open an unmarked door, but when she made as if to follow him through it, he shook his head.
No, no. First you must place the palm of your hand.
She complied, but wondered how they could possibly have her palm print and sweat signature here in Syria. No, they didn't, of course. They were getting them right now, so that wherever else she went, she would be recognized by their computer security systems. The door led to a stairway that went down, and farther down, and farther yet, until they had to be well underground.
I don't think this complies with international handicapped access regulations, said Petra.
What the regulators don't see won't hurt us, said the man.
A theory that has gotten so many people into so much trouble, said Petra. They came to an underground tunnel where a small electric car was waiting for them. No driver. Apparently her companion was going to drive.
Not so.
He got into the back seat beside her, and the car took off by itself.
Let me guess, said Petra. You don't take most of your VIPs through the El Al ticket counter.
There are other ways to get to this little street, said the man. But the people looking for you would not have staked out El Al.
You'd be surprised at how often my enemy is 2 steps ahead.
But what if your friends are 3 steps ahead?
Then he laughed, as if it had been a joke, not a boast.
We're alone in the car, said Petra. Let's have some names now.
I am Ivan Lankovsky, he said.
She laughed in spite of herself, but when he did not smile, she stopped. I'm sorry, she said. You don't look Russian, and this is Damascus.
My paternal grandfather was ethnic Russian, my grandmother was ethnic Kazakh. Both were Muslims. My mother's parents are still living, thanks be to Allah, and they are both Jordanian.
And you never changed the name?
It is the heart that makes the Muslim. The heart and the life. My name contains part of my genealogy. Since Allah willed me to be born in this family, who am I to try to deny his gift?
Ivan Lankovsky, said Petra. The name I'd like to hear is the name of the one who sent you.
Oh, one's superior officer is never named. It is a basic rule of security.
Petra sighed.
I suppose this proves I'm not in Kansas anymore.
I don't believe, said Lankovsky, that you have ever been in Kansas, Mrs. Delphiki.
No, it was a reference to...
I have seen the Wizard of Oz, said Lankovsky. I am, after all, an educated man. And I have been in Kansas.
Then you have found wisdom I can only dream of. He chuckled.
It is an unforgettable place. Just like Jordan was, right? After the Ice Age. Covered with tall grasses, stretching forever in every direction, with sky everywhere, instead of being confined to a small patch above the trees.
You are a poet, said Petra, and also a very old man to remember the Ice Age.
Well, the Ice Age was my father's time. I only remember the rainy nights right after it.
I had no idea there were tunnels under Damascus.
In our wars with the West, said Lankovsky, we learned to bury everything that we did not want blown up. Individually targeted bombs were first tested on Arabs. Did you know that? The archives are full of pictures of exploding Arabs.
I've seen some of the pictures, said Petra. I also recall that during those wars, some of the individuals targeted themselves by strapping on their own bombs and blowing them up in public places.
Yes, we did not have guided missiles, but we did have feet.
And the bitterness remains?
No bitterness, said Lankovsky. We once ruled the known world, from Spain to India. Muslims ruled in Moscow, and our soldiers reached into France and to the gates of Vienna. Our dogs were better educated than the scholars of the West. Then one day we woke up and we were poor and ignorant, and somebody else had all the guns. We knew this could not be the will of Allah, so we fought.
And discovered that the will of Allah was...
The will of Allah was for many of our people to die, and for the West to occupy our countries again and again until we stopped fighting. We learned our lesson. We are very well behaved now. We abide by all the treaty terms. We have freedom of the press, freedom of religion, liberated women, and democratic elections.
And tunnels under Damascus.
And memories.
He smiled at her.
And cars without drivers. Israeli technology, I believe. For a long time we thought of Israel as the enemy's toehold in our Holy Land. Then one day we remembered that Israel was a member of our family who had gone away into exile, learned everything our enemies knew, and then came home again. We stopped fighting our brother, and our brother gave us all the gifts of the West, but without destroying our souls. How sad it would have been if we had killed all the Jews and driven them out. Who would have taught us then? The Armenians?
She laughed at his joke, but also listened to his lecture. So this was how they lived with their history. They assigned meanings to everything that allowed them to see God's hand in everything. Purpose, even power and hope. But they also still remembered that Muslims had once ruled the world, and they still regarded democracy as something they adopted in order to placate the West. I really should read the Quran, she thought, to see what lies underneath the facade of Western-style sophistication. This man was sent to meet me, she thought, because this is the face they want visitors to Syria to see. He told me these stories because this is the attitude they want me to believe that they have. But this is the pretty version, the one that has been tailored to fit Western ears. The bones of the stories, the blood and sinews of it, were defeat, humiliation, incomprehension of the will of God, loss of greatness as a people,
and a sense of ongoing defeat. These are people with something to prove, and with lost status to retrieve. A people who want not vengeance, but vindication. Very dangerous people. Perhaps also very useful people, to a point. She took her observations to the next step, but couched her words in the same kind of euphemistic story that he had told. "From what you tell me," said Petra, "the Muslim world sees this dangerous time in world history as the moment Allah has prepared you for. You were humbled before, so you would be submissive to Allah and ready for him to lead you to victory." He said nothing at all for a long time.
"I did not say that."
"Of course you did," said Petra. "It was the premise underlying everything else you said, but you don't seem to realize that you have told this not to an enemy, but to a friend."
"If you are a friend of God," said Lankovsky, "why do you not obey his law?"
"Oh, but I did not say I was a friend of God," said Petra, "only that I was a friend of yours. Some of us cannot live your law, but we can still admire those who do and wish them well and help them when we can."
"And come to us for safety, because in our world there is safety to be had, while in your world there is none."
"Fair enough," said Petra.
"You are an interesting girl," said Lankovsky.
"I've commanded soldiers in war," said Petra. "And I'm married, and I might very well be pregnant. When do I stop being just a girl? Under Islamic law, I mean."
"You are a girl because you are at least 40 years younger than I am. It has nothing to do with Islamic law. When you are 60 and I am 100, inshallah, you will still be a girl to me."
"Bean is dead, isn't he?" asked Petra. Lankovsky looked startled.
"No," he said at once. It was a blurt, unprepared for, and Petra believed him.
"Then something terrible has happened that you can't bear to tell me. My parents, have they been hurt?"
"Why do you think such a thing?"
"Because you're a courteous man. Because your people changed my ticket and brought me here and promised I'd be reunited with my husband. And in all this time we've been talking and riding together, you have never so much as hinted about when or whether I would see Bean."
"I apologize for being remiss," said Lankovsky. "Your husband boarded a later flight that came by a different route, but he is coming. And your family is fine, or at least we have no reason to think they're not."
"And yet you are still hesitant," said Petra.
"There was an incident," said Lankovsky. "Your husband is safe, uninjured, but there was an attempt to kill him. We think if you had been the one who got into the first cab, it would not have been a murder attempt. It would have been a kidnapping."
"And why do you think that? The one who wants my husband dead wants me dead as well."
"Ah, but he wants what you have inside you even more," said Lankovsky.
It only took a moment for her to make the logical assumption about why he would know that. "They've taken the embryos," she said.
"The security guard received a rise in salary from a third party, and in return he allowed someone to remove your frozen embryos."
Petra had known Valesky was lying about being able to tell which babies had Anton's key. But now Bean would know it too. They both knew the value of Bean's babies on the open market, and that the highest price would come if the babies had Anton's key in their DNA, or the would-be buyers believed they did. She found herself breathing too rapidly. It would do no good to hyperventilate. She forced herself to calm down. Lankovsky reached out and patted her hand lightly. "Yes, he sees that I'm upset. I don't yet have Bean's skill at hiding what I feel. Though, of course, his skill might be the simple result of not feeling anything. Bean would know that Valescu had deceived them. For all they knew, the baby in her womb might be afflicted with Bean's condition, and Bean had vowed that he would never have children with Anton's key. Have there been any ransom demands? She asked Lankovsky.
Alas, no, he replied. We do not think they wish to trouble themselves with the near impossibility of trying to obtain money from you. The risk of being outsmarted and arrested in the process of trying to exchange items of value is too high, perhaps, when compared with the risk involved in selling your babies to third parties.
I think the risks involved in that are very nearly zero, said Petra.
Then we agree on the assessment. Your babies will be safe, if that's any consolation.
Safe to be raised by monsters, said Petra.
Or perhaps they don't see themselves that way.
Are you confessing that you people are in the market for one of them to raise to be your boy or girl genius?
We do not traffic in stolen flesh, said Lankovsky. We long had a problem with a slave trade that would not die. Now if someone is caught owning or selling or buying or transporting a slave, or being in an official position and tolerating slavery, the penalty is death. And the trials are swift. The appeals never granted. No, Mrs. Delphiki, we are not a good place for someone to bring stolen embryos to try to sell them.
Even in her concern about her children, her potential children, she realized what he had just confessed, that the we he spoke of was not Syria, but rather some kind of pan-Islamic shadow government that did not, officially at least, exist. An authority that transcended nations. That was what Lankovsky meant when he said that he worked for the Syrian government as often as not. Because, as often as not, he worked for a government higher than that of Syria. They already have their own rival to the hegemon. Perhaps someday, she said, my children will be trained and used to help defend some nation from Muslim conquest.
Since Muslims do not invade other nations anymore, I wonder how such a thing could happen.
You have Ali sequestered here somewhere. What is he doing? Making baskets or pottery to sell at the fair?
Are those the only choices you see? Pottery making or aggressive war?
But his denials did not interest her. She knew her analysis was as correct as it could be without more data. His denial was not a disproof. It was more likely to be an inadvertent confirmation. What interested her now was Bean. Where was he? When would he get to Damascus? What would he do about the missing embryos? Or at least, that was what she tried to pretend to herself that she was interested in. Because all she could really think, in an undercurrent monologue that kept shouting at her from deep inside her mind, was, he has my babies. Not the Pied Piper prancing them away from town. Not Baba Yaga luring them into her house on chicken legs. Not the witch in the gingerbread cottage keeping them in cages and fattening them up. None of those gray fantasies. Nothing of fog and mist. Only the absolute black of a place where no light shines. Where light is not even remembered. That's where her babies were. In the belly of the beast. The car came to a stop at a simple platform. The underground road went on to destinations Petra did not bother trying to guess. For all she knew, the tunnel ran to Baghdad, to Amman, under the mountains to Ankara. Maybe even under the radioactive desert, to rise in the place where the ancient stone waits for the half-life of the half-life of the half-life of death to pass, so pilgrims can come again on Hajj. Lankovsky reached out a hand and helped her from the car, though she was young and he was old. His attitude toward her was strange, as if he had to treat her very carefully, as if she was not robust, as if she could easily break. And it was true. She was the one who could break. Who broke. Only I can't break now. Because maybe I still have one child. Maybe putting this one inside me did not kill it, but gave it life. Maybe it has taken root in my garden, and will blossom and bear fruit. A baby on a short, twisted stem. And when the fruit is plucked, out will come stem and root as well, leaving the garden empty. And where will the others be then? They have been taken to grow in someone else's plot. Yet I will not break now, because I have this one, perhaps this one. Thank you, she said to Lankovsky, but I'm not so fragile as to need help getting out of a car. He smiled at her, but said nothing. She followed him into the elevator, and they rose up into a garden, as lush as the Philippine jungle clearing where Peter gave the order that would bring the beast into their house, driving them out. She saw that the courtyard was glassed over. That's why it was so humid here. That's how it stayed so moist. Nothing was given up to the dry desert air. Sitting quietly on a stone chair in the middle of the garden was a tall, slender man, his skin the deep cacao brown of the upper Niger where he had been born. She did not walk up to him at once, but stood admiring what she saw. The long legs, clad not in the business suit that had been the uniform of Westerners for centuries now, but in the robes of a sheikh. His head was not covered, however, and there was no beard on his chin. Still young, and yet also now a man. A lie, she murmured, so softly that she doubted he could hear. And perhaps he did not hear, but chose that moment only by coincidence to turn and see her. His brooding expression softened into a smile. But it was not the boyish grin that she had known when he bounded along the low-gravity inner corridors of battle school. This smile had weariness in it, and old fears long mastered but still present. It was the smile of wisdom. She realized then why Ali had disappeared from view. He is Caliph. They have chosen a Caliph again. All the Muslim world under the authority of one man, and it is a lie. She could not know this, not just from his place here in a garden, yet she knew from the way he sat in it that this was a throne. She knew from the way she was brought here, with no trappings of power, no guards, no passwords, just a simple man of elegant courtesy, leading her to the boy man seated on the ancient throne. Ali's power was spiritual. In all of Damascus there was no safer place than here. No one would bother him. Millions would die before letting an uninvited stranger set foot here. He beckoned to her, and it was the gentle invitation of a holy man. She did not have to obey him, and he would not mind if she did not come. But she came. Salam, said Ali. Salam, said Petra. Stone girl, he said. Hi, she said. The old joke between them, him punning on the meaning of her name in the original Greek, her punning on the hi of Hylai. I'm glad you're safe, he said. Your life has changed since you regained your freedom. And yours too, said Ali. Married now. A good Catholic wedding. You should have invited me, he said. You couldn't have come, she said. No, he agreed. But I would have wished you well. Instead, you have done well by us when we needed it most. I'm sorry that I did nothing to protect the other children. But I didn't know about them in time, and I assumed that Bean and you would have had enough security. No, please, I'm sorry. I'm reminding you of pain instead of soothing you. She sank down and sat on the ground before his throne, and he leaned over to gather her into his arms. She rested her head and arms on his lap, and he stroked her hair. When we were children, playing the greatest computer game in the world, we had no idea. We were saving the world.
and now we're creating the world we saved.
Not me, said Petra. I'm no longer a player.
Are any of us players? Said Alai.
Or are we only the pieces moved in someone else's game?
Inshallah, said Petra. She had rather expected Alai to chuckle, but he only nodded.
Yes, that is our belief, that all that happens comes from the will of God.
But I think it is not your belief.
No, we Christians have to guess the will of God and try to bring it to pass.
It feels the same when things are happening, said Alai. Sometimes you think that you're in control because you make things change by your own choices, and then something happens that sweeps all your plans away as if they were nothing, just pieces on a chessboard.
Shadows that children make on the wall, said Petra. And someone turns the light off.
Or turns a brighter one on, said Alai,
and the shadows disappear.
Alai, said Petra, will you let us go again? I know your secret.
Yes, I'll let you go, said Alai. The secret can't be kept for long. Too many people know it already.
We would never tell.
I know, said Alai, because we were once in Ender's Jish. But I'm in another Jish now. I stand at the head of it because they asked me to do it, because they said God had chosen me. I don't know about that. I don't hear the voice of God. I don't feel his power inside me. But they come to me with their plans, their questions, the conflicts between nations, and I offer suggestions. And they take them. And things work out. So far, at least, they've always worked. So perhaps I am chosen by God.
Or you're very clever.
Or very lucky.
Alai looked at his hands.
Still, it's better to believe that some high purpose guides our steps than to think that nothing matters except our own small miseries and happinesses.
Unless our happiness is the high purpose.
If our happiness is the purpose of God, said Alai, why are so few of us happy?
Perhaps he wants us to have the happiness that we can only find for ourselves.
Alai nodded and chuckled. We battle school brats. We all have a bit of the imam in us, don't you think?
The Jesuit, the rabbi, the lama.
Do you know how I find my answers? Sometimes, when it's very hard, I ask myself, what would Ender do?
Petra shook her head. It's the old joke. I ask myself, what would a person smarter than me do in this circumstance? And then I do it.
But Ender isn't imaginary. He was with us, and we knew him. We saw how he built us into an army, how he knew us all, found the best in us, pushed us as hard as we could bear, and sometimes harder, but himself hardest of all.
Petra felt once again the old sting, that she was the only one he had pushed harder than she could bear. It made her sad and angry, and even though she knew that Alai had not even been thinking of her when he said it, she wanted to lash back at him. But he had been kind to her and Bean, had saved them, and brought them here, even though he did not need or want non-Muslims helping him, since his new role as the leader of the world's Muslims required a certain purity, if not in his soul, then certainly in his companionship. Still, she had to offer.
We'll help you if you let us, said Petra.
Help me what? Said Alai.
Help you make war against China, she said.
But we have no plans to make war against China, said Alai. We have renounced military jihad. The only purification and redemption we attempt is of the soul.
Do all wars have to be holy wars?
No, but unholy wars damn all those who take part in them.
Who else but you can stand against China?
The Europeans? The North Americans?
It's hard to stand when you have no spine.
They're an old and tired civilization. We were too once.
It took centuries of decline and a series of bitter defeats and humiliations before we made the changes that would allow us to serve Allah in unity and hope. And yet you maintain armies. You have a network of operatives who shoot their guns when they need to. Alai nodded gravely. We're prepared to use force to defend ourselves if we're attacked. Petra shook her head. For a moment she had felt frustrated because the world needed rescuing, and it sounded as though Alai and his people were renouncing war. Now she was just as disappointed to realize that nothing had really changed. Alai was planning war, but intended to wait until some attack made his war defensive. Not that she disagreed with the justness of defensive war. It was the falseness of pretending that he had renounced war when he was in fact planning for it. Or maybe he meant exactly what he said. It seemed so unlikely. You're tired, said Alai. Even though the jet lag from the Netherlands is not so bad, you should rest. I understand you were ill on your flight. She laughed. You had someone on the plane watching me? Of course, he said. You're a very important person. Why should she be important to the Muslims? They didn't want to use her military talents, and she had no political influence in the world. It had to be her baby that made her valuable. But how would her child, even if she had one, have any value to the Islamic world? My child, she said, will not be raised to be a soldier. Alai raised a hand. You leap to conclusions, Petra, he said. We are led, we hope, by Allah. We have no wish to take your child, and while we hope that there will someday be a world in which all children will be raised to know Allah and serve him, we have no desire to take your child from you or keep him here with us. Or her, said Petra, unreassured. If you don't want our baby, why am I an important person? Think like a soldier, said Alai. You have in your womb what our worst enemy wants most. And even if you don't have a baby, your death is something that he has to have for reasons deep in the evil of his heart. His need to reach for you makes you important to those of us who fear him and want to block his path. Petra shook her head. Alai, she said, I and my child could die, and it would be a mere blip on the rangefinder to you and your people. It's useful for us to keep you alive, said Alai. How pragmatic of you, but there's more to it than that. Yes, said Alai, there is. Are you going to tell me? It will sound very mystical to you, said Alai. But that's hardly a surprise coming from the Caliph. Allah has brought something new into the world. I speak of Bean, the genetic difference between him and the rest of humanity. There are imams who declare him to be an abomination, conceived in evil. There are others who say he is an innocent victim, a child who was conceived as a normal embryo but was altered by evil and can't help what was done to him. But there are others, and the number is by far larger, who say that this could not have been done except by the will of Allah. That Bean's abilities were a key part of our victory over the Formics, so it must have been God's will that brought him into existence at the time we needed him. And since God has chosen to bring this new thing into the world, now we must watch and see whether God allows this genetic change to breed true. He's dying, Alai, said Petra. I know, said Alai, but aren't we all? He didn't want to have children at all. And yet he changed his mind, said Alai. The will of God blossoms in all hearts. So maybe if the beast kills us, that's the will of God as well? Why did you bother to prevent it? Because my friends asked me to, said Alai. Why are you making this so complicated? The things I want are simple. To do good wherever it's within my power, and where I can't do good, at least do no harm. How Hippocratic of you. Petra, go to bed, sleep. You're becoming bitchy. It was true.
She was out of sorts, fretting about things she could do nothing to change, wanting Bean to be with her, wanting Alai not to have changed into this regal figure, this holy man.
"You're not happy with what I've become," said Alai.
"You can read minds?" asked Petra.
"Faces," said Alai. "Unlike Ashiel and Peter Wigan, I didn't seek this. I came home from space with no ambition other than to lead a normal life and perhaps serve my country or my god in one way or another. Nor did some party or faction choose me and set me in my place."
"How could you end up in this garden on that chair if neither you nor anyone else put you there?" asked Petra. It annoyed her when people lied, even to themselves, about things that simply didn't need to be lied about.
"I came home from my Russian captivity and was put to work planning joint military maneuvers of a pan-Arab force that was being trained to join in the defense of Pakistan."
Petra knew that this pan-Arab force probably began as an army designed to help defend against Pakistan, since right up to the moment of the Chinese invasion of India, the Pakistani government had been planning to launch a war against other Muslim nations to unite the Muslim world under their rule.
"Or whatever," said Alai, laughing at her consternation when once again he had seemed to read her mind. "It became a force for the defense of Pakistan. It put me in contact with military planners from a dozen nations, and more they began to come to me with questions well beyond those of military strategy. It was nobody's plan, least of all mine. I didn't think my answers were particularly wise. I simply said whatever seemed obvious to me, or when nothing was clear, I asked questions until clarity emerged."
"And they became dependent on you?"
"I don't think so," said Alai. "They simply respected me. They began to want me in meetings with the politicians and diplomats, not just the soldiers. And the politicians and diplomats began asking me questions, seeking my support for their views or plans, and finally choosing me as the mediator between the parties in various disputes."
"A judge," said Petra.
"A battle school graduate," said Alai, "at a time when my people wanted more than a judge. They wanted to be great again, and to do that they needed a leader that they believed had the favor of Allah. I tried to live and act in such a way as to give them the leader they need. Petra, I am still the same boy I was in battle school, and like Ender, I may be a leader, but I am also the tool my people created to accomplish their collective purpose."
"Maybe," said Petra, "I'm just jealous. Because Armenia has no great purpose except to stay alive and free, and no power to accomplish that without the help of great nations."
"Armenia is in no danger from us," said Alai.
"Unless, of course, we provoke the Azerbaijanis," said Petra, "which we do by breathing, I must point out."
"We will not conquer our way to greatness, Petra," said Alai.
"What then? You'll wait for the whole world to convert to Islam and beg to be admitted to your new world order?"
"Yes," said Alai. "That's just what we'll do."
"Well, as plans go," said Petra, "that's about the most self-delusional one I've ever heard of." He laughed.
"Definitely you need a nap, my beloved sister. You don't want that to be the mouth Bean has to listen to when he arrives."
"When will he arrive?"
"Well after dark," said Alai.
"Now you see, Mr. Lankovsky's waiting for you at that gate. He'll lead you to your room."
"I sleep in the palace of the Caliph tonight?" asked Petra.
"It's not much, as palaces go," said Alai. "Most of the rooms are public spaces, offices, things like that. I have a very simple bedroom and this garden."
"Your room will also be very simple. But perhaps it will make it seem luxurious if you think of it as being identical with the one where the Caliph sleeps.
I feel as if I've been swept away into one of Scheherazade's stories."
"We keep a sturdy roof. You have nothing to fear from rocks."
"You think of everything," said Petra.
We have an excellent doctor on call should you wish for medical attention of any kind.
That's still too soon for a pregnancy test to mean anything, said Petra. If that's what you meant.
I meant, said Alai, that we have an excellent doctor on call should you wish for medical attention of any kind.
In that case, said Petra, my answer is, you think of everything. She thought she couldn't sleep, but she had nothing better to do than lie on the bed in a room that was downright Spartan, with no television and no book but an Armenian translation of the Quran. She knew what the presence of this book in her room implied. For many centuries, translations of the Quran were regarded as false by definition, since only the original Arabic actually conveyed the words of the Prophet. But in the great opening of Islam that followed their abject defeat in a series of desperate wars with the West, this was one of the first things that was changed. Every translated copy of the Quran contained, on the title page, a quotation from the great Imam Zukak, the very one who brought about the reconciliation of Israel and the Muslim world. Allah is above language. Even in Arabic, the Quran is translated from the mind of God into the words of men. Everyone should be able to hear the words of God in the language he speaks in his own heart. So the presence of the Quran in Armenian told her first that in the palace of the Caliph there was no recidivism, no return to the days of fanatical Islam, where foreigners were forced to live by Islamic law, women were veiled and barred from the schools and the roads, and young Muslim soldiers strapped bombs to their bodies to blow up the children of their enemies. And it also told her that her coming was anticipated, and someone had taken great pains to prepare this room for her, simple as it seemed. To have the Quran in common speech, the more or less phonetically spelled English that had been adopted as the language of the international fleet, would have been sufficient. They wanted to make the point, though, that here, in the heart, no, the head of the Muslim world, they had regard for all nations, all languages. They knew who she was, and they had the holy words for her in the language she spoke in her heart. She appreciated the gesture and was annoyed by it both at once. She did not open the book. She rummaged through her bag, then unpacked everything. She showered to clear the must of travel from her hair and skin, and then lay down on the bed because in this room there was nowhere else to sit. No wonder he spends his time in the garden, she thought. He has to go out there just to turn around. She woke because someone was at the door, not knocking, just standing there, pressing a palm against the reader. What could she possibly have heard that woke her? Footsteps in the corridor? I'm not dressed, she called out as the door opened. That's what I was hoping, said Bean. He came in carrying his own bag and set it down beside the one dresser. Did you meet Alai? Asked Petra.
Yes, but we'll talk of that later, said Bean.
You know, he's Caliph, she insisted.
Later, he said. He pulled off his shoes.
I think they're planning a war, but pretending that they're not, said Petra.
They can plan what they like, said Bean. You're safe here. That's what I care about.
Still in his traveling clothes, Bean lay down on the bed beside her, snaking one arm under her, drawing her close to him. He stroked her back, kissed her forehead. They told me about the other embryos, she said, how Ashil stole them. He kissed her again and said, shh. I don't know if I'm pregnant yet, said Petra.
You will be, said Bean.
I knew that he hadn't checked for Anton's key, said Petra. I knew he was lying about that.
All right, said Bean.
I knew, but I didn't tell you, said Petra.
Now you've told me.
I want your child, no matter what.
Well, said Bean, in that case we can start the next one the regular way. She kissed him.
I love you, she said.
I'm glad to hear that.
We have to get the others back, said Petra. They're our children, and I don't want somebody else to raise them.
We'll get them back, said Bean. That's one thing I know.
He'll destroy them before he lets us have them.
Not so, said Bean. He wants them alive more than he wants us dead.
How can you possibly know what the beast is thinking?
Bean rolled onto his back and lay there facing the ceiling. On the plane, I did a lot of thinking about something Ender said, how he thought. You have to know your enemy, he said. That's why he studied the Formics constantly. All the footage of the First War, the anatomies of the corpses of the dead bugger soldiers, and what he couldn't find in books and vids, he imagined, extrapolated, tried to think of who they were.
You're nothing like Ashiel, said Petra. You're the opposite of him. If you want to know him, think of whatever you're not, and that'll be him.
Not true, said Bean. In his sad, twisted way, he loves you. And so in my own sad, twisted way, do I.
Not the same twists, and that makes all the difference.
Ender said that you can't defeat a powerful enemy unless you understand him completely. And you can't understand him unless you know the desires of his heart. And you can't know the desires of his heart until you truly love him.
Please don't tell me that you've decided to love the beast, said Petra.
I think, said Bean, that I always have.
No, no, no,
said Petra in revulsion, and she rolled away from him, turned her back on him. Ever since I saw him limping up to us, the one bully we thought we could overpower, we little children, his twisted foot, the dangerous hate he felt toward anyone who saw his weakness, the genuine kindness and love he showed to everyone but me and Poke, Petra, that's what nobody understands about Ashiel. They see him as a murderer and monster, because he is one, a monster who keeps winning the love and trust of people who should know better. I know that man, the one whose eyes look into your soul and judge you and find you worthy. I saw how the other children loved him, turned their loyalty from Poke to Ashiel, made him their father truly in their hearts. And even though he always kept me at a distance, the fact is, I loved him too.
I didn't, said Petra.
The memory of Ashiel's arms around her as he kissed her, it was unbearable to her, and she wept. She felt Bean's hand on her shoulder, then stroking her side, gently soothing her. I'm going to destroy him, Petra, said Bean. But I'll never do it the way I've been going about it up till now. I've been avoiding him, reacting to him. Peter had the right idea, after all. He was dumb about it, but the idea was right, to get close to him. You can't treat him as something far away and unintelligible. A force of nature, like a storm or earthquake, where you have no hope but to run for shelter. You have to understand him, get inside his head.
I've been there, said Petra. It's a filthy place.
Yes, I know, said Bean. A place of fear and fire. But remember, he lives there all the time.
Don't tell me I'm supposed to pity him because he has to live with himself. Petra, I spent the whole flight trying to be Ashiel, trying to think of what he yearns for, what he hopes for, to think of how he thinks. And you threw up because I did, twice on my flight, and I didn't have to get inside the beast to do it.
Maybe because you have a little beast inside you. She shuddered.
Don't call him that. Her. It. I'm not even pregnant yet, probably. It was only this morning. My baby is not a beast.
Bad joke, I'm sorry, said Bean. But listen, Petra. On the flight, I realized something. Ashiel is not a mysterious force. I know exactly what he wants.
What does he want,
besides us dead? He wants us to know that the babies are alive. He won't even implant them yet. He'll leave little clues for us to follow. Oh, nothing too obvious, because he wants us to think we discovered something he's trying to keep hidden. But we'll find out where they are, because he wants us to. They'll all be in one place, because he wants us to come for them.
Bait, she said.
No, not just bait, said Bean. He could send us a note right now if he wanted that. No, it's more than that. He wants us to think we're very smart to have found out where they are. He He wants us to be full of hope that we might rescue them, to be excited so we'll hurtle into a situation completely unprepared for the fact that he's waiting for us. That way he can see us fall from triumphant hope to utter despair before he kills us. Bean was right. She knew it. But how can you even pretend to love someone so evil? No, you still don't understand, said Bean. It's not our despair he wants. It's our hope. He has none. He doesn't understand it. Oh, please, said Petra. An ambitious person lives on hope. He has no hope, no dream. He tries everything to find one. He goes through the motions of love and kindness or anything else that might work, and still nothing means anything. Each new conquest only leaves him hungry for another. He's hungry to find something that really matters in life. He knows we have it, both of us. Before we even found each other, we had it. I thought you were famous for having no faith, said Petra. But you see, said Bean, Ashiel knew me better than I knew myself. He saw it in me. The same thing Sister Carlotta saw. Intelligence, asked Petra. Hope, said Bean. Relentless hope. It never crosses my mind that there's no solution, no chance of survival. Oh, I can conceive of that intellectually, but never are my actions based on despair because I never really believe it. Ashiel knows that I have a reason to live. That's why he wants me so badly. And you, Petra. You more than me. And our babies. They are our hope. A completely insane kind of hope, yes, but we made them, didn't we? So, said Petra, grasping the picture now, he doesn't just want us to die, the way he was perfectly content to let Sister Carlotta die in an airplane when he was far away. He wants us to see him with our babies. And when we realize we can't have them back, that we're going to die after all, the hope that drains out of us, he thinks, it'll become his own. He thinks that because he has our babies, he has our hope. And he does, said Petra. But the hope can never be his. He's incapable of it. This is all very interesting, said Petra, but completely useless. But don't you see, said Bean, this is how we can destroy him. What do you mean? He's going to fall into the pit he dug for us. We don't have his babies. He hopes we'll come and give him what he wants. But instead, we'll come prepared to destroy him. He's going to be laying an ambush for us. If we come in force, he'll either slip away, or as soon as it's clear he's doomed, he'll kill our babies. No, no. We'll let him spring his trap. We'll walk right into it, so that when we face him, we see him in his moment of triumph, which is always the moment when somebody is at their stupidest. You don't have to be smart when you have all the guns. Relax, Petra, said Bean. I'm going to get our babies back and kill Ashiel while I'm at it. And I'll do it soon, my love, before I die. Well, that's good, said Petra. It will be so much harder for you to do it afterward. And then she wept, because contrary to what Bean had just said, she had no hope. She was going to lose her husband. Her children were going to lose their father. No victory over Ashiel could change the fact that, in the end, she was going to lose him. He reached out for her again, held her close, kissed her brow, her cheek. Have our baby, he said. I'll bring home its brothers and sisters before it's born.